We all want some form of clarity. We want to know that A led to B, led to C, led to D. So when you tell that story in that kind of sequential way, it feels comforting, it feels right, it's just that it's wrong.
Says Glenn Lowry, who ran New York's Museum of Modern Art for 3 decades as a director and continues to think, rethink, curate, and advise in the field of the arts. It's an enormous pleasure to welcome you to Was macht die Kunst, our podcast supported by Volkswagen Group Culture. The name of our podcast translates to "What is art up to right now," according to Glenn Lowry.
Oh, it's an impossibly difficult question to answer. I think it's especially difficult because artists are especially sensitive to what's happening, and we're in an incredibly unstable, difficult time that no one feels like they have a handle on. And I think when you look at a lot of the art that's being made today, you see how artists are struggling to make sense out of a turbulent world where all of the norms have been shaken, where wars are being started, where borders are being drawn, and where it's difficult to locate yourself. And art lives in the world. Art lives in the same world you and I live in. So I think it's one of those pivot moments where we don't know where art is going because artists themselves are trying to figure out where they're going. That said, in moments like this, art, I think, becomes even more important because it's one of the few forms of communication that work across emotional, intellectual, physical boundaries that allow us to think together, feel together, and respond together to all of these events that are shaping and reshaping our lives.
I can imagine that this was also a topic last night. You attended a night in Berlin, which is a New York-style museum gala happening for the first time like this in Berlin. How did you experience the get-together last night? How was that for you?
Oh, I thought it was a fantastic event. I mean, for Americans, these kinds of galas where you bring a lot of people together to raise money to support your museum are common. But my sense was this was almost a unique event, certainly in Berlin and maybe in Germany. And it had a buoyant, joyous dimension to it that I think reflected the affection people have for the Hamburger Bahnhof and the role the Hamburger Bahnhof has played for 30 years in the intellectual and cultural life of the city. And the word that I took away from many of the conversations was risk, the need for a place that could and would take a risk on art and artists, that was willing to commit itself to work that was uncertain, unknown, uneasy to deal with, that later becomes central to the way we understand a moment, but we don't know that at the time. And I think that's what you want from a great museum of contemporary art, that it is a place where you can see, experience, and understand what risk really means for an artist.
I would like to talk about your personal trajectory a little bit, like how you started going into the art world and even maybe earlier. What was a first memory of you as a child and art?
So it's something I've been thinking about a lot because I'm in the midst of trying to put a book together that intersects what I did over the last 30 years with why I actually did it. That is working at the Museum of Modern Art and committing myself to trying to create a conversation around art practices at a global scale. My very first memory that I know was my own, as opposed to a memory that you have received because people have told you about it, had to do with a museum and looking at a work of art, a painting by William Bouguereau, the great 19th century French artist, of satyr and nymphs that was at our local museum. And I remember as a little child of 6 or 7 years old, sitting in front of that painting and being awestruck by it. But even though that's where, in a way, my personal memories begin, my own ambitions had been to be a competitive skier. And it really wasn't until I got to university and realized, one, that I would never be good enough to compete at an Olympic level, and two, that I loved looking at art, that it made me excited, that I found it a way to think about the world, that I could understand history through objects in a way that I couldn't just by reading about history, that I realized I wanted to become an art historian. It was, and it was a bit of a crisis for me when I realized that I wasn't going to be able to live the dream I had originally had, and didn't know what to be. And, you know, one day I took a course on Indian and Islamic art out of the blue for no reason other than it met conveniently in the afternoons so I could sleep late in the morning. And from that, you know, I ended up following a path into art history.
So you were a curator for Oriental art and Near Eastern art then at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington?
When I matriculated with my PhD, there were no jobs in my field, which, by the way, was exactly what my father had told me was going to happen. He was horrified that I was going to become an art historian. So I took a job as the director of a new museum, tiny little college art museum. And 3 years later, a important post in Islamic art opened up at the Smithsonian. And I, for some reason, ended up being appointed to that job. And so I really had two different toeholds into the museum world. One as a director, but really a very inexperienced director of a tiny little institution. And then as a curator of a major collection in Washington. And I love being a curator. I mean, that's why you go into the field, because you get to work with art. You get to think about it, write about it, learn. And after 6 years of doing that at the Smithsonian, I realized that I was also interested in not just the practice of making exhibitions and writing about art, but I was also interested in how the place ran. You know, how could you make it function in new and different ways? And so I thought, well, maybe I need to go back to being a museum director. And that's how I ended up getting a job at the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto. And from there, I went to the Museum of Modern Art.
How did that shift towards the modern take place? And how do you land a job at the MoMA? I mean, this job at the MoMA, I can imagine that it's the most prestigious position in this field in the whole wide world.
Oh, the answer is easy. You study Islamic art. I'm not kidding. So my doctorate was on 16th century Islamic architecture in India. And one of the other graduate students in the program who was studying 16th and 17th century Ottoman architecture in Turkey became a very close friend. And when she finished her PhD, she went off and did a few other jobs and eventually became the head of a search firm. And one day, out of the blue, I got a phone call from her saying, you know, I just got the job as the headhunter for the Museum of Modern Art, and I promised them I could introduce them to the next generation of museum directors. Would you come and interview? And I said, you know, I really don't want to do this. Like, I'm really happy in Toronto. Our family's happy. You know, there are, you know, all sorts of rumors about how difficult the Museum of Modern Art is. And she said, I don't actually care if you get the job. I just promised them that I could introduce them. You need to do this for me as a friend. And so I said, on one condition, that you make it very clear that I'm uninterested in the job. That, you know, anyway, I went down, and I met all of these extremely intimidating trustees. And since I really didn't want the job, I was very relaxed. And I wanted the job, I would have been a disaster. So I told them exactly what I was thinking about and what I thought they should do. And next thing I know, I got the job.
Oh, that's so funny.
So it is through Islamic art. Because she would never have known about me without that.
You have said before that you wanted to understand modernity better and how the idea of the modern would transform in the 21st century. What are the biggest transformations that you witnessed in your 30 years at the MoMA that have showed like a trajectory of the modern?
By the time I got to the Museum of Modern Art, while the modern wasn't my field, and contemporary was not my field, I was deeply interested. And what I knew from studying Islamic art and the history of a region that embraced everything from North Africa all the way to Indonesia was that the claim to modernity was far more nuanced and complex than the European and North American axis that was framed by the Museum of Modern Art. And that what I hoped to bring was a more nuanced, more complicated, richer way of understanding the idea, and it's really the ideas, because it's plural, of the modern, and the ways in which these were refracted, recomposed, fragmented, and thought through in different geographies through different artistic practices. One of the fascinating things about the Museum of Modern Art, because it was founded in 1929, so it has a relatively long history for a Museum of Modern Art, is that if you look in the collection, what you discover is that there were two collections. There was the collection that was on view, quasi-permanently, that was very much a story about European and North American dialogues across the late 19th into the 20th and now the 21st century. And then there was a collection that was not on view, but that belonged to the museum. That was far more complicated. It had work by Iranian artists, by Sudanese artists, by artists from India, that had been collected in the 60s and 70s, and some even before that. And what happened was at some point in the 80s and early 90s, the idea of the modern through the lens of the then curators of the Museum of Modern Art was codified into something that was easily digested and quite axial in its understanding of the relationship between Europe and North America, when in fact, at an earlier time, the museum was really looking across geographies and even temporalities at the different ways in which artists from around the world practiced. There's no such thing as modern art in some linear, fully formed way. There have always been competing, conflicting, and contradictory impulses within the claim of modernity. And it's far more interesting to look at where things don't fit than where they do fit. And that by introducing voices from elsewhere, but also voices that had been silenced, whether it was the voice of African-American artists or the voice of women or the voice of trans artists or the voice of dissenters, by allowing those voices to animate what was already there, it made it more interesting and richer for everyone. And so that really was my goal, was to energize the museum by opening it up, and as it turns out, by reopening it up to these different impulses. And it wasn't until the second and even the third generation of curators at the museum that there was this desire to clarify the story, to make evident that this particular path was the path that should be followed and through which we should understand the idea of modern art. I wanted to, and I still believe it's essential, to keep the stories as open as possible, to in a way have a very generous embrace, to recognize that yes, there are certain artists that have achieved enormous recognition and fame and who are in fact great artists, but there are other artists whose work is equally important, even if less understood or even less appreciated in this moment, but who decades later make a lot of sense. So the museum collected a great deal of what it called primitives, artists that today we might think of as outsider, self-taught, and they made sense for a while. And then as the story became, you know, Cézanne leading to Picasso and Matisse to Léger and onward, one ism to the next ism, they didn't seem to fit. So off they went to storage, only to be returned to the conversation in the late 2010s when we wanted to show that at the same time that this was happening, so was that. And by the way, artists like Picasso looked at a lot of different sources and then digested them and did something with them. And so did these other artists. And now we can begin to see that the conversation between them is enriching, not limiting. We all want some form of clarity. We want to know that A led to B, led to C, led to D. So when you tell that story in that kind of sequential way, it feels comforting, it feels right. It's just that it's wrong. I mean, we can believe that narrative if we want to believe it. But in fact, that's not at all what happened or how it happens. And I suppose there's an urge in some of us to want to simplify. And there's an urge in others of us who want to complicate. And I don't think it's about complicating for the sake of complicating. I think it's about trying to create a way of understanding that in a moment, there are always competing positions and practices that intersect or diverge from each other. And that artists struggle, but they also struggle in ways that are worth following. And we live in a world that is so interconnected now. To not understand the ways in which different practices in the subcontinent or in Africa or throughout the Gulf region have evolved is to miss so many interesting ways of understanding the world, and that these practices can, in fact, cohabit space if you're thoughtful about giving them the opportunity to do that. And that's really what we've tried to do for the last 15 years at the Museum of Modern Art. Not necessarily always successfully, but I remember vividly one of the most controversial moves that we made during the 2019 project, which was a rethinking of the museum and an expansion, but really finally getting to the kind of hang that I was interested in seeing, was a gallery that had the Demoiselle d'Avignon, one of the most cherished paintings in the collection, Picasso 1907, the kind of departure for Cubism, a seminal painting in the history of art, in a room not only with works by Louise Bourgeois and other women, but also with a painting by Faith Ringgold, an African-American artist, who had, in fact, in the 60s, frequently gone to the Museum of Modern Art to look at Picasso. And she did a painting called Die, 5, I think, and it clearly is related to Guernica in its composition, in its scale, in its fragmentation of forms. And there were many people who said, how can you put an artist like that in quotation marks, in a room with Picasso? Horrified and angry. And there were at least as many people that said, that is so refreshing. That is so exhilarating. This is the museum we've been waiting for. So clearly there are multiple camps. My takeaway was that precisely because her work created a rub with Picasso, Faith Ringgold managed to demonstrate why Picasso, now over 100 years ago, is still part of a conversation today. And to also understand that if contemporary art and modern art are not controversial, then they've become historical, right? Like, that you want to have the debate unfolding in your space.
I once had an interview with Tony Schifrazzi. Tony Schifrazzi, who actually, he told me it was the first time he ever talked about this openly with the press. he gave me an exact account of how he attacked Guernica at the MoMA. This must have been the 60s.
Yes.
With a can of spray paint.
Green spray paint, if I remember.
So, and he was arrested and how he was then let go and how he did this not out of disrespect for the painting, but he wanted to fill it with meaning again. And it's crazy to think that he felt compelled to do it that way. Right. But of course, if somebody can do it with their own art, like Faith Ringgold, then it does reinvigorate an old painting that it shows that it's still relevant.
So here's a little bit of art world trivia. Who bailed Tony Shafrazi out of jail when he was arrested?
I don't know.
Richard Serra.
Oh.
They shared a studio at the time, and it was Richard who bailed him out. I only found that out at dinner years ago with Richard.
Oh.
Because we were in fact in Bilbao together because he was about to have a show. And of course we started to talk about Tony Shafrazi and Guernica. And he said, so like, can you guess who bailed him out? And I should have known if he asked the question, but I didn't. But you know, what that shows and that's why history and getting these details right is so important, that there are obvious relationships. This person studied with that person. This painting was based on thinking about that work of art. And then there are the hidden relationships that are also important. These two artists were studio mates, that even if their practices over time went in very different directions, the very fact that they were part of a community at a certain moment has an impact on the work they do.
Yeah.
And so that moment when, you know, Tony Shafrazi at the Museum of Modern Art is not a happy name, but it came to me how important it was to understand the invisible histories, because they tell you something too.
Absolutely. When you look back on these three decades at MoMA, can you name three projects that you are especially proud of?
All parents love their children equally, but not at the same time, necessarily. So, you know, there are a lot of different projects that I thought were really terrific. The Doug Aitken Sleepwalker, which we did in 2006, for me was a very important work because we'd invited Doug to do something, and I was really interested in working with him because we had just finished a project in 2004 of rebuilding and expanding the museum. And I was interested in how do you take the museum outside its walls? Right? I've been fascinated for decades by André Malraux, Le Musée Imaginaire, which was really about carrying the idea of a museum in your mind rather than in the concrete physical objects. And I was thinking about, well, how do you imagine the museum outside this box that we've created? And Doug was very interested in doing this project, I learned, of taking the exterior of the museum and turning it into a work of art. And it brought Doug, who was really an artist in the sort of orbit of PS1, which we had just merged with, into conversation with us. It allowed us to think about the museum as something far more malleable and complicated than the box with objects in it. And of course, it lit up New York. It was one of those magic moments. It was 30 days. Unfortunately, it was unbelievably cold, so it was hard to stand in the garden for hours watching this film. But it was fantastic. He used every surface of the exterior of the museum, like a multiplex, but telling a story about how New York wakes up and goes to sleep, of course. So that would be one. I think the exhibition we did with Richard Serra, the museum that we redesigned in 2004 was partially redesigned to be able to show Serra's monumental sculptures, which up until then we couldn't show. Not only did we not have a space big enough for those, but we didn't have a space where the floors could support the weight. So in part, we designed the museum to be able to show sculpture like Richard's. And working with Richard was one of the great thrills of my life. I knew him somewhat before, During the years that we worked on the show, we became very good friends, and that friendship blossomed into something very deep that continued until his death. And he had a reputation of being a really difficult person to work with. He was one of the most professional artists I've ever worked with. And then Marina Abramović, the artist is present, which was probably the most unexpected success of any show we've done. But also learning through Marina was as incredible a privilege as it was learning with Richard. She's an amazingly generous person. She happens to also be hysterically funny, but more importantly, she's a deadly serious artist. And one of the things that Klaus Biesenbach, who was the chief curator in charge of that project, and I and others wanted to see happen at the museum was an embrace of performance. And I think there were a lot of skeptics on our board and certainly among other curators and staff that performance at scale like that could hold an audience. And I remember explaining to our board at a meeting that, okay, this was really going to have a section of historic works that were going to be re-performed, which raised all sorts of interesting questions about how performance is transmitted over time. And then in the central space of the museum, Marina is just going to sit in a chair. And somebody said, well, how long is she going to sit in a chair for? I said, 8 hours. And for how long is this going to happen? I said, 77 days. And I remember trustees saying, so you think anybody's going to actually come and watch somebody sit in a chair for 77 days? I said, well, there'll be another chair, so you could sit with her if you wanted to. And head scratching, but you know, fortunately, the museum has a board that really believes in its curators and really believes in artists. So we went ahead with the project, and it was transformative. You know, there were something like 10,000 people a day, almost from the day we opened it. And what became really fascinating to me is, of course, the center of this project was Marina and her capacity to sit with you for as short or as long as you wanted to sit with her. And in a way, she gave you permission to emote. And she gave you a lot of emotion back, although you were staring in her eyes. You were that close, so you couldn't hide what you were feeling. And it was like a gift she was giving back to people. She's given everyone in this space permission to do that with each other. So the complete strangers started to connect. And there was a day when one person sat down for the entire day. And I had security officers calling me up going, you know, he's been there for 45 minutes. He's been there for 2 hours. He's been there for 5 hours. What do we do? And the answer was nothing. We just leave it alone. And surprisingly, the public watched. Some stayed almost the entire time. Others left. But that project taught me so much about humanity, about the way artists interact with people, about the complexity of bringing totally unfamiliar work into an environment that expects a very high level of performance. And so those would be three, but I could name you so many other projects that are equally important to me. But those were the three that came up as you asked your question.
Amazing. And they are projects that really made art history, too. Yeah. Education plays a crucial role at MoMA today. How are your different education programs conceived? Were you able to measure their actual success or their impact on society?
Oh, there's a lot of interest in that kind of analysis that would recognize impact, particularly of education programs, whether those are for young children or adults. You know, there's always a desire to know how you are affecting the people you connect with. I'm a bit skeptical that the analytic data tells you that much. We do a lot of it. It's baked into our system so that we can refine our programs. But I think the real impact often takes place long after you've connected to one of these programs. So for instance, if you're a young child and you come to the museum two or three times and you meet some interesting educators and maybe you spend time talking about a work of art, maybe you do some art making yourself and you do a survey immediately after that or even a week after that and you'll learn something. But actually, the impact might not be until that young child comes back to a museum 20 years later because what they really learned was how to be comfortable in the museum. They learned the code. They learned that, yeah, you don't have to put a tie on if you want to go to the museum. You can actually talk in a museum. It's not prohibited. You can wander around and look at things. And that level of comfort, that's a privilege, by the way, because so many people don't know that. But that may be the greatest benefit that that young person acquired, even though what you were measuring for was, did they learn a drawing skill or did they learn how to look at a work of art? So that's why I say I'm skeptical that sometimes the benefit isn't what was immediately achieved. And helping people learn how much pleasure and joy and knowledge they can get by being in the space of the museum and looking at art and actually listening to or maybe even talking to a stranger.
Your legacy is not only having brought MoMA's visitors to around 3 million a year, but also the financial endowment from $200 million to $1.7 billion. What are the biggest challenges in growing so successfully in numbers, both in terms of attendance as well as in the financial backing?
Well, first of all, I don't think of that as my legacy. Those are facts, and they happened because of a lot of people who worked incredibly hard to make it happen. It wasn't me. It was really dozens upon dozens of trustees and staff. I think of my legacy as the staff itself. Because if you can encode into the people you work with ways of thinking and approaches to curating and to engaging the public, then you rewire the DNA of the institution. And the growth in audience, that was, I think, because we did our job well. We created exhibitions and programs that people wanted to see, that they felt they learned something from, that engaged them. We rode the wave of interest in modern and contemporary art that started in the early 1990s and exploded by the end of the 1990s. In the same way that by working with an astoundingly supportive and generous board, at a time when wealth was growing dramatically, and having a team of curators and conservators and educators and security officers who could animate the joy of being involved with the museum, those extraordinarily generous people found ways of supporting the museum that they never had before. And I have to say, a lot of that generosity was led by David Rockefeller, whose mother was a founder of the museum, who had been engaged with the museum for 60 or 70 years of his life, but who in the 90s and early 2000s decided for whatever reason to get deeply involved and to make, you know, astoundingly generous commitments to the museum. And with that, he carried with him, he gave an example for people to follow, the motivation to support the museum to such a degree. And so we were able to make the argument that to grow the museum, everything had to grow. You had to grow the physical space to accommodate all of these different artistic practices. You had to grow the public to, you know, engage ever wider and broader audiences. And you had to grow the financial resources to ensure that we could continue to support these programs at an incredible level. And, you know, when I started at 1995, we had a $225 million endowment and we had almost $150 million of debt. So our finances were really shaky, but we had a board of trustees that said, we can change that. And so I was lucky to be there at a moment when they were willing to do that. You know, now it's a very different story.
The idea of the endowment is right now in the press in German media because our museum director in Frankfurt of the Städel Museum, Philipp Demand, has just announced that he wants to start a 100 million endowment, which is unusual for Germany. Can you maybe briefly describe what this idea means to have an endowment for a museum?
Sure. So, at least in North America, an endowment is a sum of money, capital, that is invested in various instruments that generate a return. And the general practice in North America is that you have access to about 5% of the return. But the idea is simple. The endowment should always be growing so that it maintains real value. And you have a steady stream of income that is not dependent on any other sources other than the capacity of the market to be active and generate a return. And it's our way, because we really don't have federal or even a great deal of state financial support, the American system throws the responsibility of culture largely to individuals. So that's compensatory for what would be very generous state funding in Europe.
I'm really curious to watch this in Frankfurt now, how it's developing and giving this institution a lot of freedoms. How about corporate partnerships at MoMA?
So corporate support has always been a really important part of the makeup of the way museums in the United States support themselves. VW was an absolutely incredible partner for the Museum of Modern Art over many, many years. And they were great partners because they didn't simply give us a great deal of money. They worked with us to, and we worked with them to shape programs. It wasn't a simple transaction. It was much more complicated than that, and therefore much richer, and I believe it lasted longer precisely because it was a engaged relationship. Interestingly, a great deal of our corporate support, which may not be true of other museums in the United States, came from non-American companies, especially around the idea of long-term support. You know, annual support, that's fine, but what we built with Volkswagen and Hyundai Card and others was multi-year support. And with multi-year support, you can really plan. And, you know, for us, it was a significant percentage of the annual income, especially with Volkswagen, which was incredibly generous to us.
I can imagine that as the director of such a large and important institution that also so many people have their eyes on. I mean, it's really always in the focus, I would say, of the whole cultural world. What is MoMA doing? I can imagine that you needed a thick skin. On the other hand, as you know, as a person in the arts, you need very, very fine antenna to be sensitive to, you know, artistic developments. How do you balance this thick skin and the fine antenna?
I remember very early on at MoMA, one of the chief curators, Peter Galassi, brilliant, brilliant scholar of photography, came into my office and said, "I'm going to tell you something. You need only one thing to survive here." And I thought, "Oh God, I'm going to get the keys to the bank." And he said, "You need a thick skin." And he said, "I'm not joking. You need a thick skin." And he was absolutely right that if you start to take any of these issues personally, you are going to be so miserable and unhappy. The capacity to be empathetic and sensitive is something, at least in my case, I had to learn. My daughter once said to me that I had the lowest EQ of any human being in the universe. And I said, "In the universe? Is it that low?" She said, "Dad, it's that low." And I... you know, learned that one of the ways to deal with issues that you're not good at is to surround yourself with people who are much better at it. and then trusting their judgment and saying, okay, if they're seeing something that I'm not seeing, I better pay attention to that. And over time, of course, you learn how to be better at things that are harder for you to do. And as long as you're learning, it's interesting.
If time travel was real, what place and period would you visit?
Fatehpur Sikri in the 1570s and 80s.
Is this in India?
Yes.
What is your most important tool?
My brain.
If you were an animal, what would it be?
Panther.
What game do you like to play?
I don't play games.
What is your favorite color?
Red.
Do you have a recurring dream?
I don't dream.
Do you listen to music while you work?
Often. Anything from Bach to Pink Floyd.
Which topic would you like to see an entire issue of Weltkunst in?
It'd be interesting today to look at what's happening in the Gulf now. I think this is really one of the most interesting places at the moment. The number of artists who had moved there, the number of museums, galleries, projects, biennials, had exploded in the last 10 years. And so how is this moment where war is fracturing this in one of the most interesting regions in the world, how is this impacting what's happening? It'd be a very interesting project to dive into.
One last question. Can you share a wisdom?
My father-in-law, who fought during the Second World War and was quite celebrated for being an extremely capable military leader, pounded into me as a young man a military adage, which is time spent in reconnaissance is seldom wasted. And I think that we often react in the moment, but thinking it through, having that capacity not to jump in the first instance, but to really understand the lay of the land, to understand a problem, to think about what the most important question is to ask. Is time very well spent, even though our natural instinct is often to just react? What's our greatest tool if we're involved in art and culture? It's our capacity to think. Right? At the end of the day, that's what art ultimately does. It makes us think. So using our minds, understanding that that is what we have been given, might have a tall body, a short body, a weak body, a strong body, doesn't matter. We might be brown, green, yellow, doesn't matter. It's what's in our brain that matters. And everybody has a brain. That is a common, and everybody's brain is good. And has the capacity to think. And, that was the lesson I took from Malraux, that at the end of the day, even the most substantial of museums, like the Louvre or the Museum of Modern Art or the Met or the Neue Nationalgalerie, the Hamburger Bahnhof, they're not actually about the objects or the building. They're about the ideas that are embedded in them.
Thank you very much, Glenn Lowry, and thank you for listening. Our partner, Volkswagen Group Culture, is also supporting Berlin's Nationalgalerie. A new edition of Volkswagen Group Art for All is starting April 2026 at Neue Nationalgalerie, every Thursday of the month, with a vast program of concerts, performances, and artists' talks.